Blog Talk Radio.
And it's another DNC clown show. And this is Ralph Pointer, What's Happening, Blog Talk Radio. And the call-in number is 347-857-3293. And tonight we are saying, liberals will never be a part of progressive change. A prime example, a vote for Joe is a no vote for national health care. And because we have a full packed schedule and a lot of folks tonight on the call, we would like to turn our mic over to Brother Ralph Pointer. Ralph Pointer, what's happening?
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. Hope you have had much rest and relaxation these past few weeks while we were not on the air, because there is much to talk about this evening. As I always begin, what I believe, Ralph Pointer, 2015. The overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, move lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes, who once protected us in our community, do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds, as well as the minds of others. Wake up, now is the time. And now is the time. It has long since been the time when we were to protect our political prisoners. But this evening's program has much in store, and I'd like to begin, before we have our poetry, or should we go to our poetry first?
Well, since we have a student with us who's preparing, I hope, for remote learning, since I don't think any of the education departments can guarantee the safety of our children or our students, we're going to call on our poet, Sister Sarah Adams, and I'm going to try and open up her mic right now. We have missed her, but she's been busy. If you check Facebook, you can see her reciting, I think, right outside her home. I'm not sure. Sister Sarah Adams from Rochester, your mic is open.
Hi. So that first poem, actually, that wasn't my house. That was actually Mr. Howard Griffin's house. He was a member of the Third Ward from Rochester. I'm not gonna talk too much about him, but he's like a legend in Rochester. Kwame Ture said, "The first thing the enemy will do is not control your history, but control your understanding of history." His story. Long, thin hair, thin lips, blue eyes. Why don't my teachers have skin like mine? Why haven't I learned about anything but slavery? I know my people were and are and will always be great, no matter what racist systems the white man creates. We are kings and queens, entrepreneurs and inventors. We were fighters, but they don't want us to remember. You see, knowledge is power, and they're scared. Because when you got a strong and educated and beautiful black person, can't nobody compare. Teach me about the political prisoners and your illegal COINTELPRO. Teach me about how the 13th Amendment and its except for a punishment for crime is just the new Jim Crow. Teach me about how before you captured and enslaved us, we were royalty. Loyalty to America, that's what it is, right? Your contributions to the system that only serves people whose skin is white and oppresses the people whose skin looks like mine. I'm so tired of sitting in class and learning about being oppressed by white people. I already learn from experience every day. Knowledge is power. I can't stress that enough. When the numbers and statistics just roll off my tongue, that's impact for real. When my brain becomes a walking encyclopedia on my history and the present day, and those people in the fancy offices realize I'm just as competent as them, they ain't got nothing else to say. You're smart, but I'm smart too. And I'm not small-minded and divisive like you. I'm willing to hear the other side, unlike you who just denies. But when it comes to a debate of America no longer being race, I will always take the prize. Seriously, that had to be a joke. America's not racist, but you can't sleep without the police killing you if you're black folks. Racism is like weeds in a garden. You can rip them out of their roots, but they'll always come back in a different form. But black people are the gardeners, so, so beautifully resilient. They will always rip those weeds away, even after a thunderstorm. I'm calling for a change in curriculum, the right to learn my history, the bare minimum. I'm calling for more educators like Mr. Howard Griffin here. Representation matters. My demands are very clear. All I want to do is learn the history of myself. So my demands, they will be met, with or without your help.
Well, listening to that poetry from that young person gives me more hope for the future. Thank you so much, Sarah Adams, poet, eighth grader, going to ninth grade in Rochester, New York. Thanks again for that, Sarah. Look forward to hearing from you and your poetry and wisdom next week.
Sister Sarah, are you going to be on the webinar that Sister Belinda Parker Brown from Louisiana has invited you to?
Yeah, I'm going to be on it. I haven't heard back about the rescheduled date, but I'm going to be on it.
Okay, so they have rescheduled it. Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay, sweetheart. Well, as soon as you know the date, you let us know so we can announce it. And I know you're a studier because your poetry is getting better and better. And all we can say is thank you. Brother Ralph?
Yes, thank you again. And because this is the week of the election mania, I'm going to read one sentence from the 2003 speech that Sister Lynn gave in Minneapolis at the National Lawyers Guild, October 26. We have detainees and political prisoners at home, and now looming in 2004, we have those Democratic and Republican conventions and then an election, with the corporate media ready to hype the results and drown out the righteous protest. Lynn Stewart, 2003, and here we go again with this, as Sister Betty called it, clown show. I will not call it that. I will call it a picture of degradation, continued degradation of the American people. But with that said, let us go to hear how others are interpreting what is happening today. Sister Betty.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. And we're going to call our brother, who is such a strong advocate of reparations and a strong advocate of Mumia, and has been on the front lines fighting for alternatives to the two-party joke system. Brother Gill, your mic is open.
Sorry, I missed. Were you saying me?
That's right. That's right.
All right. Thanks. I was switching from speakerphone, so I missed the. thanks for having me. I have a scoop for you tonight. I've been working on a press release all day. This is just a draft, so it's not released yet. It's not the final version. But that's why I'm certain this is the first time this is being read in the media. So what it is a march for reparations to African people, white solidarity with black power. And it's being organized by the Uhuru Solidarity Movement under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. On Saturday, October 17th, 2020, in cities across the nation, white people will march in solidarity with the revolutionary demand of the African People's Socialist Party that Wall Street, Bank of America, and other corporations and the U.S. government pay reparations to the African community through massive return of stolen wealth into the Black Power Blueprint, the anti-colonial economic development program of the African working class. White people must refuse to be complicit with our own government's crimes against African people. We must stand in solidarity with the African community by waging a struggle with our own ruling class and pay reparations. Our demands: make Wall Street pay reparations. Bank of America and other corporations and banks on Wall Street must pay reparations to the African community through the massive return of stolen wealth into the Black Power Blueprint, the anti-colonial economic development program of the African working class. Make the U.S. government pay reparations. Stop Wall Street's imperialist wars at home and abroad. Victory to the people of Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, and others. Solidarity with Mexican and other indigenous people. Return the stolen land. Stop the colonial police terror against the African community. Solidarity with black community control of the police. Free all African and colonized political prisoners and prisoners of war. Make all cities pay reparations for police terror and genocidal gentrification. It's time for us to be on the right side of history. The way to liberation is through reparations, Uhuru. And you can go to the website, https://uhurusolidarity.org/march to find out more about this event. We're going to be organizing. We're going to have tables every Saturday between now and October 17th on the streets in New York. We're asking organizations and individuals to endorse and join the march. It's not just for white people, but the Uhuru Solidarity Movement organizes in the white community for reparations. But obviously, we welcome the Jericho Movement. We welcome the Wamiya Movement, the New Abolitionist Movement, Black is Back Coalition, Impeachment, et cetera, to join with us, to bring people, to bring speakers to the rally and unite, you know, the entire population for reparations.
Uhuru, and thank you for that, Gil Obler. Sister Betty.
Gil, do you have any updates on Mamiya?
We're trying to get... We're trying to get more information. I mean, right now, our own lawyers are under seal. They can't even tell us what's going on, and they don't even know some of what's going on, which is outrageous. But we're trying to set up a meeting with the lawyers to get more clarity. We don't know when things are going to be in court. We don't know what's happening with this King's Bench attempt to throw Larry Krasner, the DA in Philly, off the case. It's pretty outrageous that the court is deciding how the case is going to go, and even our own lawyers don't know exactly what's going on. We have to mobilize in the street because this is what they always do.
Yes, as you say, it's the long stall, stonewalling it. They've been doing it for a long time, and they're hoping Mumia will pass with COVID-19. They hoped everything else in prison would get him. As you say, we must continue the struggle, and we must bring him home now. Thank you for that, Gil.
And thank you for the announcement. One of the things we need and we've always been able to have in this country is solidarity with people of who lack melanin, who are progressive and revolutionary. And Gil definitely represents that group. Without further ado, we want to go to our next speaker because, like I said, we have a list tonight. We see that Brother Tom is in the house. Brother Tom Syracuse, and so we're going to try and open up his mic.
Hello,
all right.
My brothers and sisters. As we're talking right now, we're missing the part of the Democratic Convention. However, I did manage to look at the two keynote speakers yesterday, Bernie Sanders and I can't think of his first name now. Barack Obama's wife.
Governor
Michelle Obama.
Yeah, that's what Michelle Obama. I'm becoming senile in my old age, and of course, listening to those two actually exacerbated my senility. Biden had the nerve to put out a chart arguing that since he had a good chance to win and Howie Hawkins, the Green Party presidential candidate, does not, progressives should vote for Biden. Now, I'm going to send that chart to you where he compares the Democratic platform with the Green Party platform, and you'll see how erroneous and doublespeak it is. The Democrats, of course, are masters at doublespeak and hypocrisy. But let me, so I made up my own chart. I made up 9 points. I want to read them to you. It's short. The first point is to phase out fossil fuels and nuclear energy by 2030. Biden does not agree with that. Hawkins does. The second point, improved Medicare for everybody. Biden does not agree. In fact, they took out Medicare for all from their platform. Hawkins pushes that. To cut the military budget by 75%. Biden does not. Hawkins does. And if you listened to the keynote speakers last night, not one word was mentioned about our aggressive, imperialist foreign policy by either one of them. The fourth point, a federal jobs program to solve the unemployment problem. Biden does not mention this. Hawkins is, does. A federal hourly minimum wage of $20. Biden is pushing $15. We're pushing $20. Double Social Security benefits and end the income cap on the Social Security tax. Biden makes no mention of this. Hawkins is pushing that. Do you know that the income tax cap is something around $100,000? So that means that if a person that makes $100,000 pays a certain amount of income tax on the Social Security, and billionaires that make over $100,000, they pay the same amount of tax. People don't know that. Refuses to accept funding from corporations and financial institutions. Biden does not refuse to do that. Hawkins does. Free education from pre-K through to public colleges. Biden proposes free PK school centers, but he certainly does not approve free education through to public colleges. And finally, Biden actually says that he is further left than any president in American history. Can you imagine what a bunch of hypocritical BS that is? Hawkins is, but Biden? Now, according to many polls, Biden is 13% ahead of Trump. And unless the moon reverses its rotation, voting for the Green Party presidential candidate will not affect the election. But that's not the reason we're in the in this election. If the Green Party increases its vote significantly, that might push Biden and this Democratic Party to take a more progressive stance. You know, if Greens thought that there was really no big difference between the Green Party and the Democratic Party, we would not be Greens. No matter what certain so-called progressives, whether in the Democratic Party or out of the Democratic Party, say, Greens will not vote for Biden. Getting rid of Trump is not the main problem. The main problem is that we have a corrupt economic and political system, and we need a party like the Green Party to expose this. And that is why the Green Party is involved with electoral politics. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for that, Tom. And I dare say that neither candidate on any level will debate with Howie Hawkins. This debate that might have been a debate, you have to hear on alternative media, and listening to Howie Hawkins is certainly worth your time. Everyone should just take a moment, although they will not hear Howie Hawkins debate the two major parties. He has more to say, more for the people than both parties, major parties put together. Thanks again for that, Tom, and keep us abreast of what's happening with the election.
The last four digits on this number, 3120. Do you wish your mic to be opened? 3120. 3120.
Yes,
do you?
That
hello?
Is Michael Smith. Yes, can you hear
okay.
me?
Okay. Brothers and sisters, we have a special guest tonight, and Ralph Poynter is going to do the honors.
Yes, thank you for that. We were looking for your number, Mr. Michael Smith. Everyone should know that Michael Smith has been a long time and is an attorney for the oppressed, I believe, starting in Detroit. And he has written a book, Lawyers for the Left. And this evening, we are going to be a part of that book or interview for that book. And I've been reminded, Michael Smith, Law and Disorder on WBAI, you must listen to it 9 a.m. in the morning, right behind Amy Goodman. Mr. Smith, would you like to give us what your opinion of the law or a definition of the law?
What is law?
Well, I would like to do that, and I'm going to tell you. But first, I want to remind people that Law and Disorder, my radio show, is on Monday morning at 9 o'clock on WBAI. And I'm no longer practicing, Ralph, even though I'm not as old as you are. I'm retired. I tell people I'm repurposed. I'm not retired. I'm repurposed. So I'm very pleased to be on the show. I've been listening since 9 o'clock, and it sounds really good. Black Talk Radio, it's just an excellent program. And I wanted to start off, as I discussed with you, about answering the question, what is law? Bill Kunstler, Martin Luther King's attorney, who defended many political prisoners, was one of the great attorneys of his time. He died some 27 years ago. But in 1994, he was awarded the Distinguished Attorney Award by the New York State Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. And he got the award along with his Columbia Law School classmate, Judge Jack Weinstein. Weinstein was a federal court judge in New York City. And Counselor accepted the award on behalf of his clients, and then he said what he thought the judge believed was the law. And this is what he said about the judge. He said he thought the judge thought that law was the considered response of a civilized society to the problem of reaching a reasoned and intelligent conclusion to disputes between the state and its citizens or between the citizens themselves. And that, he said, was the liberals' view of what law is. And then Kunstler gave his view of the law. And I want you to listen to this very closely because this is a profound thought about what the law is. He says, but my view is different. He told the audience that he thought that the law was in fundamental essence nothing more than a method of social control created by a socioeconomic system determined at all costs to perpetuate itself by all and any means necessary for as long as possible. Well, that's my view. I share that view with Bill Kunstler. That's what the law is, and that's how we see it played out.
Well, thank you for that. And all we can say to that is, go, Bill, go. But I would like to continue with this, with the lawyers you write about who defended political prisoners. Could you give us a little bit about Michael Ratner?
Well, sure. You know, Michael died 4 years ago, and he was a great admirer and supporter and friend of Lynn Stewart's. And Michael's last client was Julian Assange. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with Julian Assange, who, as we are speaking, is imprisoned in solitary confinement in Belmarsh Prison in London. Michael represented Julian Assange. Julian was charged with a conspiracy. Conspiracy is a charge that prosecutors love. It's the darling of prosecutors because they don't have to prove an underlying crime. They only have to prove an idea that somebody supported something. So it's a thought crime. And Julian was ripped out of the Ecuadorian embassy where he had political asylum, and he was charged with conspiracy to obtain and possess and publish certain documents that were given to him by Chelsea Manning. He published them in 2010, 10 years ago. The documents were the Afghanistan war logs, a lot of documents from the Democratic Party showing what Hillary Clinton was up to, particularly her being a friend of the banks, and the Iraq war logs. The Iraq war logs contained within them a video of an American helicopter gunship gunning down a dozen Iraqi civilians, two Reuters journalists, and several children. Well, that was very embarrassing to the United States when that was leaked. And it was leaked all over the place and published in major newspapers in Europe and in the United States. And that's what got under the skin of the American establishment, particularly the intelligence, what they call euphemistically the intelligence community. So Obama thought about what to do, and he realized that he couldn't indict Julian Assange because there was a law that was laid out when Daniel Ellsberg stole the Pentagon papers and had them published. Well, they indicted Ellsberg, as you know. Len Weinglass got him off, but they indicted Ellsberg, but they couldn't indict the New York Times, who published the Pentagon Papers. That was going too far. And they never up to that point indicted a publisher, and they didn't indict the New York Times. Well, when Trump got elected in 2016, that's when they indicted Julian Assange. They said, the hell with the New York Times rule, let's go after the publisher. Well, what's at risk here? What's at risk is if they succeed in convicting and imprisoning Julian Assange, they've destroyed national security investigative journalism. They've destroyed our First Amendment right to learn about what the government is doing secretly. So that's what at stake, and that's what Michael Ratner so profoundly understood. So that's the response to your inquiry, Ralph.
Yes, well, that's right to the point. But I'd like to move on to another attorney that you have to be a little older to have heard the name, Conrad Lynn. Would you give us
Conrad
a little?
Conrad Lynn was born in 1908, and he died in 1995. Same time that Bill Kunstler died. And Conrad Lynn was a wonderful, wonderful man and a very fine attorney. And what I want to talk about is his defense of Lolita LeBron. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners know who Lolita Lebron was a heroine of the Puerto Rican independence movement. She organized with three men an attack on the U.S. Congress. They came into the balcony of the U.S. Congress and they shot it up and they wounded five congressmen. She was charged and convicted with conspiracy to commit murder, even though she personally didn't shoot anybody. And she didn't try to wiggle out from under any of the charges. She could have by claiming that she didn't shoot anybody and that she was a woman and try to get some sympathy. But she stood up and said, "We're fighting for Puerto Rican independence. Puerto Rico is a colony. It's a crime against humanity what the United States does to the Puerto Rican people." And she stood up and was in prison for many, many years. So I wanted to read to you what Conrad Lynn did. I'm reading to you from my book, Lawyers for the Left. Cancer claimed Conrad Lynn, who passed away in his bungalow home in rural Rockland County, north of New York City. He was 87 years old and had been an extraordinary movement lawyer, political thinker, and activist since he joined the Young Communist League as a student at Syracuse University in 1928. He intended to enter the church, but became a minister with a different mission. Quote, "Understand this about my father," his son Alexander said as he memorialized him. "He was a communist," end quote. Communism was like that of the early Christian church in that it stemmed, quote, "from humans having a sense of responsibility for one another," end quote. Conrad had been a founder of both the National Lawyers Guild and the National Conference of Black Lawyers. Several hundred friends, fellow lawyers, judges, family members, and comrades joined his son, in a magnificent memorial meeting at City College in New York City.
Well, as a young man,
in all the time, conversations with Conrad was an event, as his friends and family recalled. He laced his observations with quotes from Kipling and Longfellow, C.L.R. James, and Franz Fanon. His fascinating autobiography is titled There Is a Fountain, a line from an old Protestant hymn. He devoured newspapers and was current with the global and local political situation. He talked politics in Harlem with Adam Powell, Paul Robeson, and especially with his friend Malcolm X. Conrad shared with Malcolm X a revolutionary internationalist view of the world and met him regularly. He saw Malcolm X developing politically, an evolution for which Conrad believed he was assassinated. And let me just conclude with this. At his memorial meeting, Haywood Burns, the great attorney, spoke of Conrad defending the Puerto Rican independentista Lolita Lebron and El Abuso Campos. LeBron, who had participated in an armed attack at Congress, sent a message to the memorial meeting affirming that, quote, "Conrad was a great man for whom I felt a very great affection." So that's what I wanted to say to you, Ralph, about Conrad Lynn.
Well, thank you for that. As a young man, that name Conrad Lynn gave us goose pimples and encouragement. Would you tell us a little about Lynn Stewart in the book?
Well,
my favorite.
My favorite, too. In my book, Lawyers for the Left, I write about or interview 27 different lawyers. And one of the lawyers that I interviewed on my radio show, Law and Disorder, was Lynn. And I'm not sure if people really focus in on what they got her for. They victimized Lynn Stewart for issuing a press release. That's what they got her for. And they didn't go after her for 2 years after the press release came out. Why did they go after her? Because the Bush administration wanted to make an example out of her. They didn't want people standing up, so-called terrorists. And her client, the Sheikh, the blind Sheikh, was a so-called terrorist. In my opinion, and I think you share this with me, Ralph, the Sheikh was set up, and he was framed up. And Lynn Stewart was asked by Ramsey Clark, the former attorney general and quite a prestigious attorney. Lynn was asked by Ramsey if she would please represent the blonde sheik on the frame-up. And she agreed to do it. And that's why they made an example out of her. The judge gave her 28 months in prison after they flashed photographs of Osama bin Laden, about 10-foot-high photographs of him on the walls. The jury was totally prejudiced. They came back with a guilty verdict. The judge gave her 28 months. And George Bush Jr.'s brother, Judge Walker, sat on the Court of Appeals. And in the federal system, you can appeal a sentence. So the federal government appealed the 28 months. They asked for a longer sentence. And Walker agreed with that. So Walker sent the case back down to the judge and said, give her more time. And I was in court that day, and I remember how dramatic the situation was. The judge said, I'm giving you 10 years in prison. And Lynn had recovered from cancer. She was in her 60s. 10 years was a death sentence. And her granddaughter yelled out, screamed out. And her lawyer got up and said, why are you doing this, judge? And the judge said, because I was told to do it. That's what I wanted to say about Lynn Stewart and how they framed her up.
And I would like to say that the people turned that around. And Obama said if anybody had 100,000 petitions, he would talk to them. We were well on our way to 100,000 when Lynn Stewart was released. Thank you for that, Michael. And for the last, would you tell us a little about Lenny Wineglass?
Well, sure. You know, people might remember Lenny Wineglass was for a time Mumia's attorney. He wrote the brief that helped Mumia get out from under the death penalty. But Len Wineglass' last case, just like Michael's last case was the Julian Assange case, Lenny Wineglass' last case was the case of the Cuban Five. And he worked on that case up until the end. He was reading briefs in his hospital bed. The Cuban Five were framed up again on a conspiracy charge because, remember what I said, conspiracy doesn't involve having to prove the commission of a crime. It's a thought crime. And the charge against the Cuban Five was that they went to Miami and they spied on these counter-revolutionaries in Miami that were trying to harm the Cuban government. And the charge against them was a conspiracy to commit espionage against the United States sometime in the future. What was a flaky charge? The venue for their trial was Miami, which was a hotbed of Cuban counter-revolutionaries. You couldn't get a fair trial in Miami. And what the Cubans did was they were asked by the Cuban government to come to Miami and spy on the Cuban counter-revolutionaries. The Cuban counter-revolutionaries were using Miami as a base to commit crimes of terrorism against the Cuban tourist industry. At that time, the Soviet Union had been destroyed. The last remnants of socialism, private property, you know, the Soviet Union took a lot of backward steps, but it never abolished the nationalized private property system that they had. They didn't have capitalism in the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union was a supporter of Cuba and aided them materially. So when the United States succeeded in overthrowing the Soviet Union's form of property ownership and reinstituting capitalism in the Soviet Union and breaking it up, the Cubans were left without a lifeline. They decided that they should try to cultivate their tourism industry. Cuba is a beautiful country. It's as large as all the rest of the Caribbean islands combined. It has hundreds of miles of beaches. The Cubans reached out to European countries, particularly Spain and Italy, and they partnered with them and built hotels, and they had a flourishing tourist industry. While the Cuban counter-revolutionaries, with the encouragement of the CIA and the FBI, started bombing these tourist hotels. They started bombing buses. They started bombing the airport to try to discourage tourism. They killed an Italian tourist. So the Cubans sent the Cuban Five to Miami, not to spy on the United States, but to keep track of what these counter-revolutionaries were doing. They compiled a huge dossier. They turned it over to the FBI, and they said, please, these people are violating your laws. Please prosecute them. The FBI instead figured out from the dossier who the Cubans were, arrested them, framed them up on a conspiracy charge, tried them, and sentenced them to very, very long prison sentences. And Len Wineglass represented the Cuban Five. And that's my response to your question about Len Wineglass and the Cuban Five, Ralph.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Michael Smith. And one more sentence, an informative and inspirational insight into the minds of some of the most incredible public servants this country ever produced. Ajamo Baraka speaking about Lawyers for the Left, Michael Smith. Thank you so much for your time.
Before you say goodbye to me, you can get Lawyers from the Left from the publisher Orr Books, O-R. If you go to orrbooks.com on the internet, you can place an order, and they'll push a button. It'll get printed up and mailed to you the next day. Lawyers for the Left, orrbooks.com.
It's a book everyone should have on their shelf. Thanks again for that, Michael Smith, and we will continue. Sister Betty.
We hope you'll come back for the next book, and thank you so much. Take care.
I'd love to.
Ann Lamb, New York City, Jericho, your mic is open. Brother Mark, hang in there. And to everyone that's on the line, we have extended the program to 10:30, and we hope you'll hang in there with us. Sister Ann from New York City, Jericho, your mic is open. And Brother Jihad, we're honored to see your number in the call. Sister Ann.
Yes, Brother Jihad said that he was listening in. He's doing a second job. He's door dashing. So he can listen while he can't participate because he needs his GPS. Anyway, we have some good news to impart, which is always nice. So I don't know how many people know that our dear brother, Julio Muntatim, had put in an Article 78 appeal of his last parole denial, you know, last year, because it was basically denying him once again due to the nature of the crime, which they're not supposed to do according to the law. So he's represented on this appeal by attorney Kathy Manley, who is a specialist in this area on parole appeals. She has had several judges hold the parole board in contempt in other cases. And they had a hearing August 4th in front of Judge Schick, Sullivan County Supreme Court. That's the same judge who made the favorable decision that Jaleel should be released to Rochester due to the COVID. So we have a short order from him. I want to read it. It's dated August 10th, so this is just recent news. Upon consideration of the notice of petition and petition with exhibits of Kathy Manley, Esquire, the answer and exhibits of Assistant Attorney General Elizabeth Gavin, Esquire, the reply affirmation of Kathy Manley, Esquire, and the oral argument held via Skype on August 4, 2020, it is hereby ordered that the petition is granted to the extent that the parole board shall afford the petitioner a de novo parole hearing, which shall take place in September 2020, when petitioner was already scheduled for his regular parole hearing. In the event that the de novo hearing results in denial of release, the regular hearing shall occur within 60 days of the de novo hearing. It is hereby ordered that the de novo hearing shall consist of at least two parole board members, none of whom sat on the October 2019 panel, which was the basis for the instant petition, right? It is hereby ordered that if the parole board denies release after the de novo interview, it must provide an individualized explanation for departing from the completely low COMPAS risk scores and must specify the COMPAS scales from which the board departed. And, last paragraph, it is hereby ordered that if the parole board denies release after the de novo interview, it must provide an individualized explanation for said denial based on the record. Signed, Honorable Stephen J. Schick. So that's one of the few judges I could
We are looking forward to that day but it again is justice denied, but it's a step, two steps in the right direction.
Well, a couple of steps in the right direction. This will be Jaleel's 13th, counted 13th parole hearing. Maybe you'll be lucky 13 for a change, because Kathy Manley did say at the oral arguments that if necessary, you know, she would hold she would come back to Judge Schick and request that he hold the parole board in contempt if they once again deny him. So that could get extremely interesting.
I assume that you will send out the links if this becomes a Zoom webinar like it was the last hearing, that you will let people know. And in the meantime, who should they be writing to encourage Tish James or anybody else not to mess with this one?
Well, this is not up to Tish James. This is up to the parole board.
Okay.
Yeah. So we don't have, you know, ways that we can write the parole board directly. They have every, they're very shy about giving out their information, so to say the least.
They should get in touch with Jericho so they'll know what you would require to support Jaleel. Is that it?
Well, we're still doing a commutation campaign to Governor Cuomo for, you know, commutation of Jaleel's sentence to time served. Not that we're necessarily expecting the governor to do that, but it is always good to keep the pressure on. All that information is on both JerichoNY.org and the JerichoMovement.com, including a link to the order that I just read you and various good articles that have come out about Jaleel. And, you know, a lot of information there. And I would encourage people to keep that pressure on Cuomo, you know, call him and write him and, you know, demand that this man be freed. He's done 49 years in prison.
Thank you, Ann.
And I think people should do it. I did want to talk a little bit about a couple other people. Dr. Matulu Shakur, as you know, is waiting on a decision now from Judge Haight about the second round of the compassionate release. But also, he does have a lawsuit that was filed against the U.S. Parole Commission and the Bureau of Prisons. He will need, you know, money for this, financial support, for his legal defense, for the commissary, for if the fact that he doesn't get compassionate release, which, you know, could happen, then once again people will be going to the parole board. The lawyers are basically doing all this pro bono, but, you know, family and friends of Matulu Shakur does provide, you know, for them to travel so they don't have to put it out of their own pocket, legal costs, you know, copies and all those kinds of things, very expensive, they add up. So people can go to MatuluShakur.com, which I would encourage everyone to do. If you don't know much about Matulu, you can certainly find out here. Has a lot of good information. And you can donate directly, and that would be a big help for Matulu. And you also, of course, can write to Matulu. You can write to everybody. I always think that's a great idea. But if you're writing to anybody in the federal prisons, you must remember that you have to write everything in black and white. You can't use even a label anymore on these, you know, on anything you're writing to somebody in the feds. You have to write your address by hand. Paper and envelopes must be white. No greeting cards or envelopes with address labels are accepted, right?
And so I would assume all of that information on the Jericho website, and we must move on. It's very important for Dr. Matulu Shakur, all of our political prisoners. We could spend hours. And how can we forget some? But anyway, we're
also looking for money for legal fees, you know. So you can go to sundiatacoli.org and do it right there. You can go to jerichoNY.org and do it right there. I will definitely add the information about Matulu. There's also petitions people can sign for Matulu. There's a petition people can sign for Jaleel. All those links are up on both jerichoNY.org, I repeat, and the jerichomovement.com. And Sundiata's campaign is also on JerichoNY.org and the JerichoMovement.com. And I will definitely put Matulu's up as well. In addition to his own website, we will have it on ours as well. So thank you for reminding me of
great work, Ann. Much appreciated. Without Ann, I dare not think about without Ann. Thanks again, Mr. Betty.
Well, thank you.
All right. Somebody from the People's Federal Party because you don't have to stick with the clown show that's going on right now. So we're going to open up the mic for this brother who is an organizer supreme, who understands that if we're going to win, we've got to unite and fight the same enemy. Brother Mark Torres, your mic is open.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for having me on. It's always great to be here with the family. Just, you know, want to reiterate that, you know, what's going to get us through this COVID and economic crisis is going to be grassroots organizing and linking the different issues that y'all are so great at highlighting. And that's what, you know, when nobody should expect our salvation from the Democrats and Republicans. We really have to, you know, if we want to save lives, we really got to take action. And so, you know, for tonight, I just wanted to remind people that, you know, there's a big eviction crisis happening. You know, a lot of people got their $600 economic unemployment boost taken away, and there's a lot of people hurting. People are struggling. You know, it reminds me of Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey, where, you know, they went into the communities and they had people develop co-ops and they had ways of mutual assistance. And we have to prepare to do these things, and, you know, so our communities can survive and thrive, because whether it's the Democrats or Republicans, they're both controlled by the rich and the billionaires. And even something like voting, I mean, you know, at this point in New York State, we need to vote for third parties like PSL and the Green Party. In swing states, you know, the saying is, if you have to vote blue. But really, our liberation is not going to come from these two corporate parties. It's going to come from us doing our own work and taking care of our people. So, you know, just want to let folks know, don't get so caught up in the hype. Do what you got to do, but always understand that we have to save ourselves. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for that, Mark, for that is the truth. We must save ourselves. Sister Betty.
Brother Mark, do you have a website for the People's Pueblo Party?
Yeah, what we use Facebook, and you just look up People Pueblo Party, and Pueblo is the Spanish word for people. So, you know,
yes,
we wanted to make sure that our name was in English and Spanish, because especially in New York, the unity between African-Americans, Latinos is going to be key to any movement in that city.
Right on. Thank you so much. Okay, we're briefly going to turn the mic over to Brother Jihad Abdul-Mumit, the chairperson for the National Jericho Political Prisoner Organization. Brother Jihad, your mic is open.
Yes, if you can hear me, I can only speak very briefly. I'm kind of working at work at the moment, as Sister Ann had brought out, but I'm just tuning in to listen. I tuned in just to catch the last part of the bios of the attorneys. I definitely want to get that book. So, and there's a rich history there, and I just hope that putting that out there like that will encourage attorneys in this day and age to reevaluate their role in the movement. All due respect to everybody working on cases and things of that nature. There's been certain venues that I think Ralph and Sister Lynn, before she passed, we were at there with the, I'm not even going to mention the names really, but we were in New York City, I think it was, and trying to elicit the support of a major law outfit. And there wasn't a single attorney that would step to plate to represent. You remember that, Ralph? To represent.
Oh, do I remember? I love Lynn.
Sister Lynn blasted everybody at that meeting. It's just that what I'm saying is that capitalism has put us in such a state of mind, in such a financial predicament, that everything that we do is so much centered around not so much the human need as it is in a movement, but you can't do a single thing without the money, even supporting a brother's freedom. And I understand it, and it's very complicated, but that's how it is. That's the vestiges of capitalism, you know. So when you talk about somebody like Sundiata Okoli, then if you don't have 30 grand, then that'll eliminate his chance even getting legal help. And that's just how it is. You know, everything is wrapped up into the nuance of raising cash to pay attorneys. I mean, I look at the history. It's not that the attorneys in the past didn't get paid, don't get me wrong. But I'm talking about a certain attitude of, I mean, there's very few Bob Boyles and Gret Brodies and Dustin Daniels. You know, there's very few people, Sophia Eliza and Joan Gibbs, Hal Engel. The numbers are getting lower in terms of actual movement attorneys. So if anything, by that presentation that I just caught the end of in that book, I hope one thing that it serves besides the edification and us learning about the attorneys of the past and the great work that they did, but hopefully it will serve as an encouragement for new attorneys coming forward to really step up to the plate. There's a brother that I think everybody listening may know. His name is Najee Mujahid. One time he was part of D.C. Jericho. Now he lives in Philly, and he's a new attorney. He has his license to practice law, and he had said that the education of attorneys, just like, and I'm sure you can tune in with this, Betty and Ralph, how defunct the educational process is. He said that when he was going to law school, that one of the cases that they critiqued was the case of Huey P. Newton and the murder of police officer David Frey. I think that was his first name. And as they were critiquing this, this was in his law class, and they spent a lot of time on this case, the arraignment process, the time frame, you know, the conviction, the statutes involved, blah, blah, blah. He said never once was it ever mentioned the social and political context that Huey Newton was the founder or even just the member of the Black Panther Party. That never came up. So you have a classroom full of students, young, listening and critiquing this, and just by that omission, it equals miseducation. Just by that omission. I mean, it was incredible when he had said that. And if he didn't know about Huey Newton himself, and in this day and age, a lot of new people may not. You know, so you missed the whole social political ramification why that situation even happened in the first place. Exactly. But nevertheless, I just want to salute the brother that gave that that presentation that I just caught the end of. But and so I just want to say, well, just a few more things, and then I'll go because I get back to work. That on this weekend past, you might have already talked about it, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph and myself, we had presented on the Black is Back Coalition. And the theme of that annual conference was the freedom of all political prisoners. And, you know, this is the coalition has a membership of about 15 to 16 organizations, each and every one of them adopting the call of freeing all political prisoners. This is a major step in bringing awareness. I think it's a couple of the last program that we were on before the hiatus with Block Talk Radio here. You know, we were talking about the issue of how to infuse the narrative of political prisoners into the Black Lives Matter movement, not so much the organization itself, but the movement that has taken a presence all over the world, and how can we put the question of political prisoners front and center in that narrative. So this was a major step toward accomplishing that end. So I guess more information will be coming out as a result of that conference. And through this program, Block Talk Radio with Sister Betty and Brother Ralph and Ann Lamb giving the reports on political prisoners. And I'm emphasizing that to all the listeners because front and center of any struggle that speaks of liberation and human rights that's taken on any magnitude and significance always has to put political prisoners high on the agenda. You cannot move forward without freeing the freedom fighters that preceded us. So with that, I will continue to listen, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph, but I just give you my love and greetings, and that goes to everybody that's listening. Assalamu alaikum. Well,
thank you so much for that. And I always remember Lynn Stewart speaking before attorneys saying, if a political person calls you a political prisoner, it is an honor. You do not speak of money. And I love her for that. And it's Well, we have to work on that. Sister Betty.
All right. I want to pick up on one thing that Brother Jihad said about how political prisoners need money. And I want to acknowledge Ann Lamb, because she takes from her pocket every weekend to feed our political prisoners in Sullivan County Jail. And it should be acknowledged, and she should not have to do that. It's our job to start campaigning and get funds to the lawyers, funds to their commissary, funds to their families. Thank you, Brother Jihad. Thank you so much for calling in. We are honored. Sister Gwen, your mic is open, and we've got Henry and Dolores. So people hang in there with us. That's why we extended the time. Sister Gwen, your mic is open.
Hi, everybody.
And don't blow in the wings.
And don't. Okay. Hi. I just literally got home from my parents' house, and I'm covered with poison ivy and quite uncomfortable. But I heard on the radio on the way in. I was listening a little bit to the Democratic convention. And I was really shocked at how many votes Bernie is getting. I didn't think Bernie was even going to be. I thought he wouldn't even be even part of this, really. And so I don't think it's all doom and gloom, because I think that this election, where it's going to be different, is I think that these Bernie people are not going to they're only going to give this vote to get what they want. And already I heard a concession tonight, and I was very happy to hear this, that when people are 60, they're going to start allowing them to get Medicare. I know that's not a huge thing, but they're putting it out right now, saying that that's a definite thing that's going to happen, which I think that's good. I think there should be Medicare for all. I don't think tonight, myself personally, I don't want any rotten tomatoes thrown my way, but I do think Donald Trump is extraordinarily dangerous, and I'm not messing around this time with a third-party vote, which means I choose to throw it out. I choose to allow Donald Trump to get in another term. I'm not doing it because I wouldn't mess around with Adolf Hitler either, and I think that he's as serious as Adolf Hitler, and I think that Joe Biden is not a very great or credible or anything, but I do think he's a ball of putty. I do think he's going to be compelled to jump through a lot of hoops. He's going to be like President Johnson. He'll probably be a one-term president, not just because of his age, but because there's going to be a lot of voices that are not going to shut up when he gets in office. So I don't think everybody should – look, I'm not saying this is going to be the best season for anybody, but I know that 4 more years of Donald Trump, I really and truly believe – could kill a lot of us, and I think the stakes are that high. And I'm not going to be cynical about it. I don't think that you're right to be cynical and say poo-poo, that everybody's the same. No, they're not the same. They're not. I never heard Democrats, a lot of them, you know, get up and start throwing away all the environmental laws and just say it doesn't matter, I'm a pro-pollution candidate. I mean, Donald Trump does that. I never heard anybody from the Democratic Party say we should close down the United States Post Office, for crying out loud. My husband was a postman for 32 years, and I believe in the post office. So, you know, these are centrist issues somewhat, but Donald Trump is a lunatic. And if you think that it's not important this time, then what time does it get important? Does it get important when we're all lined up going to be killed at the wall? Because believe me, political prisoners are some of the first ones to go down. They have an X on their back. You have an X on your back. So we've all been out here for a long time protesting, and they know who we are. And I just feel that Donald Trump is as serious as a heart attack. And I don't want to have a heart attack if he gets to be the president again. And I see that the numbers, like last time, are starting to get closer and closer. I am so disappointed. It looks to me like when he put Harris on the ticket, that the numbers got tighter. That's just terrible. But anyway, I just want to say that, you know, I believe as the rest of you believe. I don't have a lot of faith in our politicians, but I also believe that the cynical route, just saying I'm sitting on the sidelines, not going to participate, I'm going to throw my vote out this time, this isn't the time to throw your vote out. Every once in a while you have to be very pragmatic. And so I have to take my ideals down, and I really truly believe that when he gets in there, that the country is restless enough, has hit the streets enough, that they're going to be out there. But that means we also have to be out there, because you know what? This movement is being formed by a lot of billionaires outside throwing money at it. I still believe they want a race war. A race war is a lot easier for them to handle, and they want a race war so classes don't get together. So I think the most important thing is that this movement become a class-driven movement, and that we all get in there and start to put our points of view across to our lovely millennial kids and let them know that the grown-ups have something to say too. We have a point of view and we have a direction to go into. So that's my thoughts for tonight. I hope I don't get any flying tomatoes after this, and I thank you for letting me speak.
Yes, your voice is always welcome, Gwen, even though I disagree with it, but it's always welcome, and we will go next.
Ralph, I hope it's just my opinion, not my voice.
Your opinion. I oppose your opinion.
I like my voice.
Okay. Next, we must have a representative from the Green Party. Last two numbers, 4295. Can we have
Paul? Your mic is open.
Thank you. Thank you, Sister Betty, Brother Ralph, for having me on. And I'd like to talk about, give you a little Marxist interpretation of the Kamala Harris situation. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah,
that's fine.
Okay, well, first of all, let's go back in American history, the Revolutionary War. Remember, and most of us know this, that upon independence from England, they only granted rich white men the franchise to vote and actually be real citizens. You know, you needed property qualifications. And so theoretically, the Jacksonian democracy, you know, brought in the franchise. They brought in poor white men. So people never say, well, why did they do this? And the answer is that the ruling classes needed these poor men to conquer the West. They needed to broaden the franchise to get more people linked up with the system, to be integrated into it. As they conquered the West, they used finance capital from the East to help expand their business, et cetera, and next you know. So they used the franchise as a way of encouraging people to participate in the state. Now let's flash back to now. All of a sudden we see Kamala Harris, Barack Obama, Colin Powell, all kinds of people who are now being included in the franchise. They've actually brought in the franchise to encourage black people, which I'm glad, you know, we're all equal. That's great. I'm not denouncing that. What I am denouncing is the reason why. And the reason why is because we're now in an imperialist state and they just need more people. They need the loyalty of the black bourgeois to help institute the imperialist project, because they simply need more people. And I will, any comments, Ralph, Betty? I hope I wasn't saying anything that was wrong.
No, you're right on the money, and that's why we picked you to answer the question. Without telling you, just knowing who you are, we knew that you would have a response, and we want to have this as a democratic philosophical program with the desire to free political prisoners. But we have to have truth all the time. And history, truth is there. So never ask that question. Just speak your truth, and we are honored to have you on the program.
And what we love about both you and Gwen and Anne is God, is that you put your body where your mouth is. You talk the talk, walk the walk. So we respect that. And we're going on to another warrior. We hope you'll come back next week and give us more. But we've got another warrior in the wings, and we've got Sister Dolores and Brother Henry to take us home. So we're going to go to Brother Joel. Brother Joel, your mic is open. We need you to cut it a little short to leave room for Gwen
Dolores and Henry. But please, Brother Joel, prepare us of what more you're going to say next week. Get started.
Joel, your mic is open. Joel, 8672, your mic is open. I see you on the board. We cannot hear you.
Okay, so we'll move on to...
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we hear you.
Oh, yes. Sorry for the delay. Apparently the phone had clicked off a little bit, but it's amazing how narrow the perspectives are that the ruling class is allowing us to vote for. The book ends very close. But one of the most outrageous things that Donald Trump has done, for example, is to turn over the Golan Heights, a part of Syria historically, something which no other president has even hinted at, to turn over U.S. recognition of the Golan Heights as Israeli territory. And then combined with that, they also did something that no previous president has done, which is recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and practically eliminating any possibility of either the illusion of a two-state solution to the basically pushed out of their own land by what amounts to a European invasion. And when Bernie was asked about that, and he's supposed to be the left wing, way to the left of Biden, he said he would not reverse those changes immediately if he were president, meaning he would never reverse them, meaning that even he supports them. He also told the New York Times in an interview that he would make preemptive strikes against Iran and North Korea to stop their nuclear development. Preventive strikes. In other words, he would go to a full-scale, possibly nuclear war against Iran and North Korea. Biden has defined himself as clearly to the right of Bernie Sanders, who was supposed to be the left wing of the party. And we look at his performance, he collected all kinds of money to oppose Biden's candidacy from the left, and then for practically no reason, but he still had a chance to pile up primary votes and more delegates, which he said he was interested in. He pulled out of the race with really no explanation as to why he had to do that. Why not keep it going? And turned over all the money that people had given to him in the name of fighting against the Biden candidacy to the Democratic Party under the Biden candidacy, and now is uncritically supported that. So, and he's supposed to be to the left of the rest of it. So people can be in a dilemma. I can understand that. About, we have to be, as Gwen said, pragmatic, because we got to get Trump out of there, otherwise he's going to grow cancerously, and maybe in another 4 years we can full-scale fascism. And yet people don't really want to vote for the imperialist programs that the Democrats sometimes criticizing Trump for the right. Offering as opposition. So I can see, but whichever decision you make on what's practical to get Biden in, let's say to buy more time, if that's really true about the country moving further and further to the right, you have to keep your eyes and ears open as to what both of these parties represent. And to organize independently
for a revolution against the capitalist system that both of these parties are very deeply invested in and very much a part of brainwashing the people about. We haven't heard anything about freeing political prisoners from any of the Democratic Party representatives. Nothing about that. Nothing about failed rulings. And we have to begin organizing so that we're not just left those choices, and so that the so-called third parties can become the first party and the only party that represents the united masses of working people and oppressed people, and link to the struggle around the world against imperialism. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for that, Joel. That's brilliant. And I'm sorry we missed some of that because of the connection. But I would wish people would listen to this program again. It's archived. You have to hear that perspective. Sister Betty.
All right, we're going to move on. Sister Dolores has been very patient, and so has Brother Henry. They're going to take us home. Your mic is open, Dolores. Thank you so much for waiting.
Oh, you're very welcome, my dear. Speaking of the Democratic Convention, on Democracy Now!'s program today, there was primarily most of the program was about the convention last night. It's very interesting if you get a chance to, you know, check it out, the archives. The one thing I wanted to mention tonight was a new book that's come, Isabella Wilkerson. It's called, the previous book was The Warmth of Other Suns, and it was a story of the decades-long migration of black folks fleeing the South for northern and western cities in search of a better life from 1950 to 1970s, and she personally interviewed about 1,000 people for an account of their journey, including researching official records, and included accounts of how those cities that they migrated to it changed our country and the cities that they went to. And one of our own, Gabby Bird, was one of the people whom she interviewed and used as a source. But I want to point out, now that she comes, she has a new book out, Isabella Wilkerson, and it's called CASTE, C-A-S-T-E, The Origins of Our Discontents. Okay, and the book is about the misperceptions about race that have disfigured the American experience. So she says that she wants to get across and persuade people that the two notions of race and caste are both addressing the internal wounds that in America has failed to clot. But she favors using the word caste in terms like dominant caste and favored caste and upper caste and lower caste. And she writes that a caste system is an artificial construction, you know, a fixed and embedded race of human value that sets presumed supremacy of one group against the presumed inferiority of other groups on the basis of ancestry and traits that would be neutral in the abstract, but turn out to be ascribed life and death meanings. So she talks about caste in terms of respect, authority, and assumptions of competence, which is accorded those who have you know, who are and are not accepted. And she makes comparisons between India's treatment of untouchables, Germany's treatment of Jews, and America's treatment of African Americans. And she says that each country relied on stigmatizing the deemed inferior to justify the dehumanization that's necessary, you know, the lowest ranked people at the bottom, and rationalize the protocols of enforcement. She mentions about Martin Luther King taking a trip to India. And she said when he got there, he was being introduced as an untouchable from the United States, and that he immediately got offended. But later, when he thought about it, he realized that as a black person in the United States, we are and have been at the bottom of our society's hierarchical system. And she gives examples, you know, about slavery and Jim Crow and where we are now even. But when she's talking about the election of Trump in 2016, she was saying that people are questioning why did the white working classes in America vote against economic interest. But she said there's a notion of white resentment. What was possible for these people voting this way was, in fact, that they were voting in their own interest. Their interest is maintaining the caste system as it had always been, and that was their interest. And some of them were willing to accept short-term discomfort, forego health insurance, risk contamination of water and air, and even die to protect their long-term interest in the hierarchy as they have known it. So I'm suggesting that people get a hold of the book. The previous book about migration was about 600 pages. When I started reading it, I had to put it down for a while because it's just too upsetting. But, we have to really think about why we're at the bottom of the ladder and the deliberateness and intentionality of it as opposed to other groups that are in this country. That's what I wanted to mention.
Thank you so much, Dolores. Our journalists, so important, these discussions and these issues that she covered. Mm-hmm. I recommend both books, and you will hear more about them if Dolores will come back next week and give us. We have a few moments left. Henry Higgins, 7845, would you take us home?
Okay, Ralph. I want to mention five books that I think would help clarify for those people who are new to the struggle or need some grounding to recommend. First book is War is a Racket by General Smedley D. Butler. Second one is Expanding Empire by Vince Copeland. Third book is Market Elections, again by Vince Copeland. The fourth book is Murder Incorporated by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria.
All right.
And the fifth book is The Empire's New Clothes by Paul Street. And he focuses mainly on the Obama administration. And that's it.
Could you repeat that list again?
Yes.
This is what love about my comrades. They do their homework. Please repeat that list again.
Yes. War is a Racket by General Smedley D. Butler. Expanding Empire by Vince Copeland. Market Elections by Vince Copeland. Murder Incorporated by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria. And The Empire's New Clothes by Paul Street.
Thank you so much for that, Henry Higgins. And I asked Dolores to come back next week and give us details about some of these books, I'm going to ask you to pick one and come back and give us more information about it. Sister Betty.
Anything by Mumia is always welcome. You know that. We have the last four digits are 1111. If you want to put in a quick comment, feel free before we take it home.
Hi there. I apologize for coming in so late, signing in so late, as I had several doctor's appointments that I could not cancel. But and also I apologize if I got to repeat, or say something that might have already been covered. But along the lines of what Dolores just mentioned, actually just a point, you know, she did mention the caste system and also, all the atrocities that are inherent with such. And again, I apologize if this has already been covered, but I am really disappointed with the election or selection rather of Kamala Harris, as she does hail from a caste-based society, which she has not, as of today, disavowed. So that clearly is an omen, for what's in store for America. Especially those of us who are already considered to be of a lower caste, you know, expendable and such. One need only consider, you know, her several voyages, which she's acknowledged and which has also been reported in the papers now, to her home country where the caste system still exists, you know, her ancestors. I'm talking about, you know, from her mother's side. And I personally also have been actually raised in that society. So I'm talking firsthand, you know, even though I've lived in America for a long time and I've studied and, you know, pretty much devoted my life to the uplifting of the law of the caste that has been oppressed for so long, you know. Again, you know, I apologize if this matter has already been acknowledged or has been covered, but clearly it cannot be, you know, understated as to what is in store for America should this lady, you know, attain the White House, you know, or even in the position to then unleash, you know, the atrocious, you know, inhumanity that comes with any caste system, especially, you know, at the behest of one who is in a position to unleash further, not just strife, but further hurt. And that's putting it mildly, by the way. So I'll just want to leave it at that, you know, lest, you know, we get distracted with the frills of my point. But clearly, we have to redouble. Let's put it this way: we have to redouble our efforts, you know, in making sure that this lady does not attain a position where, not to repeat the word, but the caste will befall, you know, the lower class, the oppressed class in America. Thank you for listening to my side.
So much for Holmes, and will you please come back next week to continue this discussion? It's very important. And I say to all of our listeners, the program is archived. You can listen to this over and over again as I do, because we have wonderful, wonderful people expressing truth to power. Thanks again. Good night, all. Much love.
Good night, everybody. Please come back next week. We've got to get the word out to the public. Thank you.